This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
She doesn't accept her position, as it were, even as she defers to Le Corbusier, and she does this throughout the novel, and even as she says, you're the genius, I'm not, she's still challenging the very kind of tenets of his own architectural kind of principles.
The story of Minette De Silva, an influential but overlooked Sri Lankan modernist who author Shiromi Pinto thinks we should all know a little bit more about. Plus...
What I often asked the architects and the homeowners was, you know, during the building of the house, where the builders had their lunch or where they took their breaks, and almost inevitably they said around these courtyards.
Design writer Charmaine Chan speaks in praise of courtyards, and we'll get the design headlines too from writer Katie Tregidden. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Don't go anywhere. And a very warm welcome to Monocle on Design. Talking about design, especially on the radio, of course, requires a little bit of imagination. And there's no shortage of just that in a new book entitled Plastic Emotions by author Shiromi Pinto. The novel provides an ever so slightly fictionalised account of the very real relationship between two influential figures in 20th century modernist architecture, Sri Lankan architect Minette De Silva and Swiss-French maestro Charles-Édouard Jeanneret, Le Corbusier to you and me. I spoke with the author of Plastic Emotions, Shiromi Pinto. She started by telling me why she'd plumped for fiction as a medium for discussing these architect stories.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I am a writer of fiction, at least, you know, when it comes to writing books. That's always something that I wanted to do, right? I would always end up writing a piece of fiction. I also thought, well, her life is extraordinary. It probably would have made a great biography. But the central sort of premise of the book is rooted in this relationship between Minette and Le Corbusier. And that relationship is actually a speculative one, because neither of them admitted to actually having any sort of intimate relationship. They certainly had a strong friendship, and their letters are sort of suffused with, you know, fondness. But neither of them ever said that they, and they wouldn't, would they? Not during that period of history. Neither of them ever admitted to actually having, you know, an actual physical relationship. And so I felt like I could explore that best through fiction. Equally, she was a woman that I thought, you know, other people really need to hear about. And I do think that writing fiction makes that individual a bit more popular, makes the story more popular. And certainly more people, you know, actually know about her now since I've written the novel. So that was another, I guess, objective that I had in writing the book.
And there is no shortage of books about Le Corbusier. His kind of brand of muscular modernism is well known. You can find him on the Swiss currency. He's a well-known character. If you would you give us a couple of the broad brushstrokes of Minette De Silva's kind of life and work, just so we know what kind of context we're working in?
So yeah, Minette practiced at the end of the 1940s into the 1950s. And actually straight through to the 1980s, but her heyday was really that late 1940s, right up until the end of the 50s. And she was from Sri Lanka. She was from a town called Kandy, which is in the hill country of Sri Lanka.
Beautiful, bucolic kind of area, right?
It really is, you know, tea plantations, all of that. And she studied architecture both in Bombay and in London. She came here to study at the Architectural Association. And then she became the first Asian woman to be an associate of the Royal Institute of British Architects. So this was a big thing when you're talking about that immediate post-war period. And so she really, you know, sort of achieved a great deal as an Asian woman in this male-dominated profession. And I would also add that it's dominated really by white men. And there's this woman of color, you know, kind of, you know, not only putting herself really on par with some of these architectural greats like Walter Gropius and Le Corbusier, but she's also challenging their sort of notions of modernism and bringing her own interpretation of what modern architecture is in her context. So she studied here in London, and then she returned to what was then Ceylon in 1948, which is just after independence. And her style of building was mainly these kind of low-slung villas, but she also had she was very budget conscious. So she really looked at trying to, you know, build with the context in mind and with the client's budget in mind. And I do think that her having to be budget conscious was driven by the fact that many of her clients also kind of questioned her because she was a woman and often demanded that she produce things, you know, at a much lower price. I don't think they would have necessarily done that with a man.
The power gradient between these two characters as the story unfolds, I think, is rather interesting. You have the godfather of modernism, a man rethinking and kind of telling you how to use buildings under a very kind of unifying scheme. This is how you use something. These are the amenities you need. And then this other voice, this voice of a lesser known past. We're discovering more and more female architects who had a profound effect on the course of history, but maybe whose voices weren't heard. Is that power gradient something that suffuses the novel? Is it a woman trying to get her voice heard? Is it a love story? And give us a little bit more about the kind of the emotions between the two of them, plastic or otherwise.
So, yes, their relationship does change quite a bit throughout the novel. And certainly there is this kind of power dynamic. I really wanted to look at this idea of, you know, this reality, actually, of here's one architect at the apex of his career. Here's another architect who's just starting out. You know, already they're at this kind of unequal level. But she, you know, she doesn't accept her position, as it were, even as she defers to Le Corbusier, and she does this throughout the novel. And even as she says, you're the genius, I'm not, she's still challenging, you know, the very kind of tenets of his own architectural kind of principles. And so, you know, they write to each other. Much of their correspondence is punctuated by, you know, romantic yearning in places, but that happens early on and it sort of quickly dissipates. A lot of it is actually technical and also political. So they're talking about the evolution of, or rather a kind of architectural revolution during this nationalist project that's happening both in India and in Ceylon. And they're both tackling it in very different ways. And Le Corbusier is effectively taking his vision of a modern architecture and imposing it on a landscape, and that landscape is in India, in Chandigarh. And Minette is taking her own very individual and unique approach, which looks back at the arts and crafts tradition in Ceylon and actually synthesizes it with modernist architecture. So much of their conversation is sort of around this. He always actually was very, very respectful of Minette, and he admired what she did. But I'm sure he never really questioned his position in relation to her. And I, in my own way, have tried to bring that out. Some people say that, you know, he comes across rather badly. And
Do you think that as the author? Was that intentional?
You know, in places, perhaps, because there is a certain arrogance that he carries with him, which is, I suppose, a function of his prestige and power. But he also is a vulnerable, aging man. And I think that was
his weak point. He has his own insecurities
exactly.
As well.
Exactly.
I just want to come to the title quickly. Plastic is today not an unproblematic subject in the world of design and sustainability, but I suppose there are implications around the time that this novel is set, of plastic being a good thing, a malleable thing, a solution to problems, as well as one that potentially doesn't always age well. What's the kind of symbology and what's the thinking behind Plastic Emotions as a title?
So this is very much the term plastic, I think, in European languages, particularly in French, les arts plastiques. This is like talking about the malleability of something. So I took this phrase from Le Corbusier's Towards a New Architecture, which is his seminal work. And he is talking about those things that can be seen, yes, but he's also talking about the idea of architecture as being a poetic space. And so I'm sort of playing with that, but also with this idea of plasticity or even ductility, you know, the idea that something is malleable and therefore the emotions, the relationship is malleable. And so this structure of the book, this structure of the building, the structure of the relationship, all of those things have an impact on, you know, the interiority or the kind of the emotional space. And so I'm trying to bring out the fact that, of course, all of the relationships that I'm writing about, whether it's the relationship between Minette and Corbeau, or the relationship between Minette and her female friends or her sister, all of them are kind of subject to this sort of molding by historical and political context.
Shiromi Pinto there, author of Plastic Emotions, which is out now on Influx Press Books. Do go and find yourself a copy. It's well worth reading. You're listening to Monocle on Design. In a moment, we'll be enjoying a little time outside with Charmaine Chan and mulling over her new book, Courtyard Living. Courtyard Living, as we mentioned, is the book from Charmaine Chan, and it's published by those talented souls at Thames and Hudson. Under the covers are glimpses at outside spaces found tucked within a building's walls, as the author wonders at how courtyards can provide respite, fresh air, light, and social spaces. Chan is based in Hong Kong, where she is the design editor for the South China Morning Post. And earlier, this show's producer, Tom Hall, spoke to her about design across Asia, her new book, and how architecture affects daily lives in Hong Kong.
I have two small courtyards within my house. And I guess the reason I wrote the book was when I started thinking about how to relate to my architect what I wanted in a home, I wasn't able to find much out there that helped me. I mean, there was lots of academic writing and there were books on Chinese quadrangle houses and Moroccan riads and Spanish colonial houses, but nothing that really answered my needs. So that's why I wrote the book.
The feature of a courtyard itself, it sort of sometimes implies almost a sense of the grandiose, because to have that space inside a building, you obviously automatically need to be building a fairly big building in itself. And, you know, that takes obviously time, money and resources. Are these homes that are purely aspirational, or do we see courtyards in much more sort of condensed and typical living situations?
They do fall into the luxury category, but they're not always very, very expensive. I went to a courtyard house in Sri Lanka on the outskirts of Colombo, and that entire house was built for US $65,000. I mean, the main reason it was so cheap, I guess, was that the architect worked pro bono and the owner helped build the house himself. But it also was fairly affordable because the owner, who is an artist, decided not to have any glass on the ground floor area and decided just to have a very, very simple home that was mostly open, even upstairs where there were bedrooms. So they can be very expensive, but they can also be not so.
Let's talk about the sort of the real architectural features then. What practical uses and benefits does a courtyard bring to a building?
Well, definitely light and air. That goes without saying. But also in very hot areas. And I went to India, on the outskirts of Mumbai, I should say. These houses provided shade, so that brought the temperature down. And when I looked at houses in very dense areas, I saw that, you know, courtyards could be inserted into houses to give people not just an outdoor room, but somewhere for the kids to play. And it was a communal area. So it was where people got together naturally for meals or just to hang out. And also going back to India, you know, some of the courtyards there provided real microclimates. And I felt it when I went into these houses and you know, spent some time around the courtyards. They were definitely cooler areas. And what I often asked the architects and the homeowners was, you know, during the building of the house, where the builders had their lunch or where they took their breaks. And almost inevitably, they said, around these courtyards. So these courtyards, they make the house or the rooms surrounding the courtyards that much more comfortable. I'm not an expert on feng shui or the Hindu equivalent, which is Vastu Shastra. But I found that in one home in Thailand, the feng shui practitioner told the architect to go back to square one with his design because the new house could really only be built on one half of the plot. Don't ask me why. You know, feng shui means wind and water, literally. And it's all about the flow of energy. And apparently wind scatters energy and water holds it. And it's best to get the balance just right. So, you know, often these feng shui practitioners actually saw eye to eye with the architects or vice versa on things like where the entrance should be or how to incorporate water elements or even what plants to put in the courtyard. You often found things like the tulsi, which is the holy basil in Hindu courtyards. And, you know, people are always talking about wellness these days. Comfort is so much a part of wellness.
One term sort of jumped out of the book when I was reading it, which I was not familiar with. It might be a very commonplace architectural term, but you wrote about introverted homes, and I had not considered this concept, you know, a home that kind of looks inwards, like mostly because outside space surrounding a home that instantly turns it into, you know, it turns it into a garden, or it turns it into, you know, grounds, or it turns it into more land that maybe you can't buy. So is a courtyard a way of sort of creating a garden within the footprint of the building as well? Is it sort of a sort of clever cheat in that way?
Definitely. And actually, I did use that word introverted in my brief to my architect, because I like the idea that, you know, the focus is inwards. It's not outwards. It's not out to the street. Maybe that's just the kind of person I am. But I wanted a house that allowed you to basically focus on the navel, so to speak. And it just allowed me to think about being free, because I wasn't being watched by neighbors, or I could live freely.
You live in Hong Kong currently. I mean, that's well known as a incredibly busy, populated place where I guess space is at a premium there. Do you think that that mindset, that your sort of fondness for the privacy of a courtyard maybe grows from being in a city in which everyone is rubbing up against each other and no one can get any space?
Definitely. I've been in Asia probably for way too long. And yes, we live cheek by jowl here. So when I was able to, I did say that this, my forever house needed to be a house in which I wasn't overlooked by neighbors. No one from the street could see me. I definitely wanted a house that was private, not a house on a desert island, but, you know, a house in which I could be myself without the fear of anyone seeing me.
We'll return to the book in just a minute, but I thought it would be interesting to talk about Hong Kong briefly from a design perspective. I mean, we're obviously seeing on the news the protests day in, day out, and one of the issues being highlighted within one of the many is the sort of standard of housing in Hong Kong. I mean, do you see, as a design writer in the area, do you see sort of design being politicized in that way and architecture sort of playing a part in people's quality of life and how people feel about the design of the spaces they live in?
Well, the Hong Kong government will often say that there is a land shortage in Hong Kong, and that's mostly true. It's also to do with the fact that the Hong Kong government owns all the land that can be developed in Hong Kong. So they auction off small parcels of land annually. And it's generally the rich developers that buy these parcels of land, and there's no real incentive for them to provide affordable housing. Yes, I mean, this is one area that's fueling discontent, and you're seeing that anger spilling out on the streets where protests have continued for about 3 months now. I think the whole anger was encapsulated by this piece of graffiti I saw recently. Actually, I saw a picture of it near where I used to work, and that piece of graffiti said $7,000 per month in rent for a flat that is the size of a cell, and you think we are afraid of jail. I mean, it really grabbed me because it's about £700 a month for a flat that perhaps could be the size of a car parking space. So we have lots of particularly younger people who probably don't see much of a future for themselves in Hong Kong, partly because the idea of ever owning a viable home is just impossible.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that. And yeah, it looks like something will have to be done and something will have to change. Coming back to the book, were there favourites for you? Is there a sort of favourite kind of courtyard you like to see?
I guess it changes every day, but I really fell in love with a house called AW House by Andra Matan. And that is a house in Jakarta. And it's not one of your leafier courtyards. In fact, there's only one tree in it, but it's a beautiful tree. It's called the Moringa tree. And I particularly like this house because Andra Matan had thought about not just architecture to be looked at. He thought about choreographing movement around the courtyard. And he built ramps to connect the different levels. And as you go up these ramps, you are always looking at that beautiful Moringa tree and the courtyard. And another reason I like that house is that the architect made a concerted effort to make every level of the house feel like the ground floor. So, you know, on the first floor, you would come out of the kids' bedrooms and you would see what looked like a paddy field. In fact, it was just a very deep planter of lemongrass. And then on the rooftop, you also had a sense that it was somehow grounded because there were infinity ponds on the edges and there were mature trees in the grounds. And also, I just like the aesthetics of that house. So today, I would say it's AW House.
Charmaine Chan there discussing her new book, Courtyard Living. It's available now from Thames and Hudson. We'll be getting some design insights and craft news next with Katie Trigidden. Do stay tuned. Katie, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Well, I'm very well indeed, and I'm always very excited to see what you've picked for us as topics to cover. These are kind of things that some people may have missed. There's some things that people might want to go and take part in. And the first pin in our global tour is in Helsinki. Why are you taking us there, Katie?
I think this is a really interesting exhibition. It's a company's solo show entitled Secret Universe. And the review in Crafts magazine actually positioned it as how not to culturally appropriate, which I thought was a really interesting perspective.
It's a very 2019 perspective,
it
isn't
is.
It?
But Aamu Song and Johan Olin have spent 10 years. They started in Finland, where they're based, and then they've been to Japan, Russia and Mexico. And what they've done is really spent a long time understanding the cultures and the traditions and the folklore in those countries, and then worked with local manufacturers to create a collection of 300 objects, clothing, accessories, furniture, that sort of thing, that are shown in this exhibition. And I think it's just really interesting. They're looking at sort of endangered craft skills and alternatives to mass consumption. And I think the whole thing started because they were wondering why things are made so far away. So they did this sort of investigation into local production. But they position themselves as an art and detective agency. And I think there's a real clue in that word detective. They're really sort of curious and really getting under the skin of a culture, not just sort of nicking a bit of it. And I think that's really important in this sort of cultural appropriation debate. But there's a real playfulness to their work as well. So it's, I think it's a really lovely collection of objects.
I love it. And there's a few kind of strands to pick at. You know, we've seen some fairly high profile faux pas from companies using images, using logos, using perhaps words that are taken from a culture, but don't kind of pay heed to the culture that it comes from and kind of seek to make a bit of money out of it. So I think there is an increasing interest in this kind of ethnography, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
Studying a culture, getting into it and understanding it. Katie, you wrote a rather wonderful book about pottery. You also wove a rather nice narrative about textiles, and that brings us on to our next point. What is the deal with it? Why are we so interested in weaving at the minute?
It's strange, isn't it? There does seem to be a huge resurgence. I think the 100th anniversary of the Bauhaus has had something to do with it. And I think the sort of right and proper attempt to relook at the way history has been told and tell the stories of some of the women involved in design history. And then there's also been a recent series of TV shows on BBC Four, which included a profile on Annie Albers. So I think that message is sort of getting out to a wider audience. But yeah, weaving certainly seems to be hot right now, to use the common parlance.
And there's also a bit of, I suppose, a process of getting away from your backlit screen, physically manufacturing something. Uh-huh. And that interest has gone from William Morris up until today for various reasons. But you can't really weave on your own. You need a big set of kit, you need a loom. So is it feasible as a hobby for people?
Interestingly, you can actually weave on a tiny little hand loom. You can get
by you, I mean me in that context.
You can get a kit online for about 30 quid, which is a little wooden frame that's about A4. And you can actually weave something. And one of the weavers in my book actually works only on those little hand looms. So it's more accessible than you might think.
Did you give it a bash?
I did.
How'd you do?
I think I'm quite a uptight person, and that came across in my weaving, let's say.
What the listeners won't know is Katie's wearing a big woven shawl at the minute as we speak. It's rather decorative, rather nice. And last up, Labour and Waite is a rather special little shop on Redchurch Street in East London. It's probably the most written about place on earth. There is a good reason for that. It stocks lovely artisanal products with, again, a kind of, I suppose it's a theme that we've come back to through all of this, something a little bit homespun, something a little bit crafty, something a bit useful. You can buy a bucket in there, you can buy a brush, a scrubbing brush or whatever. But they're also doing interesting things elsewhere in London to celebrate their anniversary, are they?
Yes, they've got a pop-up at Lascaux, which is the big salvage yard in London. I think it's really interesting. Labour and Waite was actually set up by a couple of menswear designers because they were frustrated by the sort of cycle of fashion and the fact that nothing was around long enough to become an icon. And I think the name says that, Labour and Waite. But I think there's a really interesting sort of juxtaposition in the very functional, utilitarian nature of their products, which have those sorts of things have become quite throwaway. So, you know, you mentioned the bucket. You sort of imagine £5 bucket from B&Q that you'll just throw away, whereas their buckets are beautifully handcrafted and sourced, and it's the sort of thing you're going to keep forever. I think craft has sort of been elevated to art, and I'm doing air quotes when I say elevated. And I think it's important to remember that craft can actually be highly functional and highly utilitarian, and that's also really important. That's no less than craft as art.
Thank you so much, Katie Tregidden. That was Katie Tregidden, design writer and friend of the show.
Pleasure.
And with regret, that's all the time we have for today. For a change this week, a quick plea. If you are enjoying the show, do share it. And of course, feel free to leave us a review. If you have any ideas, thoughts or musings, then do feel free to contact me at jaf@monocle.com. For more design stories, hit subscribe to this show. And you'll also get our mini midweek podcast, On Design Extra. Good name, eh? It's available each Thursday. This week we'll be peering into courtyard life as it unfolds in Budapest. Monocle on Design was produced by Tom Hall. It was edited by May Lee Evans, and many thanks to our researcher this week, Louis Allen. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.